الحمد لله، الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا محمد، وعلى آله وأصحابه وأمته مبارك وسلم. قال الله سبحانه وتعالى: فأعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، واعتصموا بحبل الله جميعا ولا تفرقوا. وقد قال الله سبحانه وتعالى: فأعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. وقد قال النبي صلى الله عليه وسلم: عليكم بسنتي وسنة الخلفاء الراشدين المهديين، عدوا عليها بالنواجذ، إلى آخر الحديث. Today we'll conclude the subject of Shiism. A quick synopsis will be forthcoming, inshallah, before we conclude it. But before I do that, it may be good sometimes to remember the significance of the day of Jummah. Because there's so few people, it may be good. Actually, maybe not good. But nevertheless, to recount the blessings of this day. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam mentioned in many ahadith the virtues of this day. In one, for example, he said that on the day of Jummah, man bakara wa abtakara, the person who wakes up early and he makes all his necessary preparations in the early morning, wa ghasala wa ghtasala, he bathes, he grooms his body, he's fastidious in preparation for this auspicious day, wa masha ila al-masjid, and he walks to the masjid, wa lam yarkab, avoiding any conveyance, obviously, if you're living in proximity to the masjid, showing one's dedication and one's desire to exert himself to his fullest in reverence of this day. And when he enters the masjid, فَدَنَا مِنَ الْإِمَامِ, he sits close to the imam, not at the back. فَاسْتَمَعَ وَلَمْ يَلْغُ, and then he listens attentively and he is not distracted and preoccupied in other frivolity. And this is his attitude to the day of Jummah, understanding that this is a sacred day. It's amongst the holy times that Allah has decreed for humanity, through which we earn Allah's good favor. Even had there been no formal Jummah, no formal prayer, congregational prayer, the day of Jummah still enjoys the full bounty and the full favor and the blessing associated with it. It's a day in which we are beneficiaries of Allah's favor and His grace and His mercy and His generosity. Today we take full advantage of that, begging of Allah as beggars do before the door of a generous king. And in this way, we earn his good favor to the point that Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, a person obviously recognizing the reverence, at least the significance of this day and showing it due reverence, كَانَ لَهُ بِكُلِّ خُطْوَةٍ عَمَلُ سَنَدٍ, that for every step he takes to the masjid, he gets the reward of a whole year's of worship, أَجْرُ قِيَامِهَا وَسِيَامِهَا, a whole year of devotion and dedication to Allah and worship throughout the long nights, praying to Allah and fasting throughout the long days in earning proximity to Allah and His good favor. So, the day of Jummah is a day that we need to give due regard to and give due reverence to. It's also a day that which if we neglect, we are depriving ourselves of Allah's good grace and His favor. And not just that, we expose ourselves to tremendous spiritual harm. There's a hadith where the Prophet ﷺ said that the person, مَنْ تَرَكَ الْجُمْعَةَ مُتَأَمِّدًا, who neglects his Jum'ah salah deliberately, without any valid excuse, some life-threatening disease, for example, or some obstacle that he cannot, in spite of his best efforts, overcome. So he is negligent and careless regarding his Jum'ah. He neglects it. That كُتِبَ مُنَافِقًا فِي كِتَابٍ لَا يُمْحَى وَلَا يُبَدَّلْ. He is then recorded in the presence of Allah as a munafiq, a pretender to faith, in such a book that is never erased and is never altered. So they're grievous warnings. The Jummah is the minimum that distinguishes a Muslim from, well, a pretender to faith. So it has to be given its due regard. It's the last barrier of sorts between a person, kufri wa shirk, a disbelief in association with Allah. So it's a day of great blessing, but also a day if we neglect, which brings tremendous harm to us. To continue with our bayan, our talk for today, and to conclude the subject in Shiism, we mentioned that the purpose was to inform and not to necessarily disparage. The intention is not to create conflict, but to create clarity. And we mentioned also that considering that the Shiite so-called Sunni divide is a matter of great contention and is prominent in the media, it's important for us as Muslims to understand where we are vis-a-vis the Shiite sect, their history, some of their beliefs and practices, but also understanding it in the context of modern geopolitics, how in no way does a difference or deviation from the practice of Islam and the Muslim community throughout ages in any way justify a war of sedition and subversion and the destruction of a sovereign nation. We mentioned how the Shiite are not a homogenous group. They're not one single religious or ethnic community. But they are divided into many religious orders. You find the Kaysaniyah, the Mukhtariyah, Hashimiyah, Bayaniyah, Ithna Ashariyah, Sabaniyah, and the list just goes on and on and on. And each have their own conflictual, mutually exclusive, sometimes and very often contradictory belief and value systems, to the point that many Shia don't regard other Shia as believers. So they're not a homogenous group. They represent a very small percentage of the Muslim world, about 6%, 5% of the Muslim world. But one thing they all agree on, as we mentioned before, was the elevated status of Ali bin Abi Talib, whereby he is elevated to being a God incarnate, like the Alawi Shia do, believing that God, or Ali, is God incarnate. Ali, hu Allah, na'udhu billah. Some believe that his progeny and him held such an exalted position that could not be reached even by angels and prophets, and there are many other mythical and fantastic beliefs associated with Ali bin Abi Talib, believing he's sinless, believing that he was intended to be a messenger, believing that he enjoys divine authority over creation and the like. We did also mention how the common belief is that of the Imam of Sayyidina Ali, he is legitimate, according to them, successorship to rule over the Muslim community after the demise of the Prophet, and they assert that this is a principle of faith. We talked about how they use certain verses of the Quran out of context and make certain statements, some of them quite incredulous and quite fabricated, whereby they suggest that Ali was designated as the successor after the Prophet. And we mentioned that the problem is not negating this, the problem is actually accepting it. And we went on to explore the logical extension of the theory of the Imamate of Ali and how this fictitious assertion of the successorship of Ali would suggest by definition that all the Khalifs prior to him and the companions as a whole in general stand guilty of apostasy and rebellion, infidelity, hypocrisy, villainy, and that they are classified as not just disbelievers but even Muslims for holding these noble personalities in reverence and affection. The whole Muslim world is now condemned from beginning to end as guilty of the unpardonable criminal act of rebellion against Allah, His Prophet, and are dwellers of hell eternal. We also said that the other extension of this belief is that the Quran no longer is a tenable document. It's a natural corollary to the doctrine of Imamate. Please remember that the Quran was codified and given its present form and shape under the Khilaf of Abu Bakr and Umar and Ali and Uthman radiallahu anhum ajma'in, and under their official patronage. And that these very people, according to Shiite belief, were the destroyers of the order established by the Prophet, peace be upon him, and they had their own personal and political agenda, and they tampered with the Quran and altered it to suit their purposes. So the Quran is no longer a valid religious document. We also said another corollary to the belief in Shiism, at least the Imamate of Ali bin Abi Talib as suggested by the Shia, is that the Prophet himself proves to be wholly incompetent and unfit and unqualified for the job which Allah designated him for. Why? Because it's a painful indictment of his inadequacy and his lack of charisma and his lack of spiritual authority and his incompetence, in that he could not even influence and impress his ideas on his closest associate over a period of 23 years. They all become apostates. The Prophet obviously is incompetent in communicating his message, na'udhu billah. It also suggests that he was guilty of wickedness, not just wickedness, but also hypocrisy, because being divinely inspired, he was aware of the mischief of the of the companions who were disbelievers, according to Shiite theory. And on account of fear, rather, and of cowardice, in spite of being associated with them for such a long time, he continues to treat them as trusted companions. He practices deception and subterfuge and cowardice. So the Prophet's integrity becomes highly questionable. Also, we say that belief in Imamat of Ali also implies that Allah is guilty of the most insidious, the most diabolical joke ever played on humanity, because he chooses an incompetent man, Muhammad, whom Allah knows invariably will fail in conveying his message, and that his message will be destroyed within the first day of his demise. And then Allah holds the salvation of mankind contingent to, well, following the way of Muhammad, which obviously is lost. So the question as to what Allah's motives were in choosing such a man become, well, an indictment of Allah as a benevolent, generous, loving creator who desires the guidance of humanity. We also know that it also reflects very negatively on Ali bin Abi Talib himself, if we assume that Ali should have been the first Khalif. And I'm doing this as a quick recap because we're concluding this today. And he knew the truth, and he knew the consequences to humanity, which were quite disastrous. Because these men had usurped his right, which was part of the preservation of the faith authentically as Allah had intended. But he acknowledged their rulership, and he collaborated with them for more than a period of 23 years. And these were apostates and infidels, and they were usurpers. And what he does is that he becomes guilty of cowardice and hypocrisy, in fact of complicity in the destruction of the faith that he's supposed to be the defender of. He is their Wazirul A'la, their prime minister and their vizier for more than 23 years. So it begs the question as to Ali and, well, his integrity as a person knowing the truth. The least we said that the picture of the earliest period of Islam that comes to view in the light of the theory of Imamat and the beliefs of the Shia can make any sensible person justly question the validity of Islam, because how can it be maintained that this religion has a capacity to reform people, it has a capacity to set right their morality, to correct their belief system, to raise them from the lowest depths to the highest pedestal of spiritual and moral excellence, when even at the hands of its founder, Muhammad, and at the height of its glory during his prophetic era, it could not leave any durable or lasting impression on his immediate followers? So how could we suggest that it has any hope of reforming people in this day and age? So the only conclusion we can draw is that in this contemporary world, we know about political deceit and trickery, and that the Prophet of Allah seemed to have been very much a person who was covetous of power. Similarly, these very cunning political manipulators in the form of Abu Bakr and Umar and Ali, they were all involved in a cunning scheme to gain power and authority, and one simply managed to outwit the other, namely Abu Bakr and Umar and Ali. So Islam just becomes, well, pretty much a Greek myth, a saga, you know, not a religion. So the problem with Shiism is accepting it, not rejecting it. Now, like we mentioned from the very outset, the purpose was just to acquaint those amongst us who are unfamiliar with the very basic beliefs. If you want to know more about the details, please come to me. I'll flood you with literature about it. But these are some of the basic beliefs and doctrines and the implications of Shiite belief. And as Muslims, obviously, we've become the target of tremendous and misleading propaganda. And every attempt has been made to lead Muslims to believe that Shiism is part of Islam. It's always been regarded as a sect, as a faction that grows from Islam, that fractures from it. The very word Shia means a fracture or branch. It's like Sikhism, which emerges from Islam and then branches off, or Baha'ism, which emerges from Shiism and then branches off. So this has been a common occurrence throughout the history of all religions, including Islam. It's not part of it, it's born of it, but then fractures from it. So the attempt has been made to make Muslims believe that it is part of Islam. The Shia have always been a protected minority within Muslim lands. They've been afforded the freedom to practice their religion as they so wish. Under all the great Khilafas, whether it was the Banu Abbas, or the Banu Umayyah, or the Ottomans, or the Mughals of India, they were afforded their own independent religious status. Like the Sikhs, for example, in India. or any other religious community in any other part of the Muslim world. Also, the other thing is that the leaders of the Shiite group are not beyond Shia-Sunni differences. They're not really advocates of Islamic unity. They use it as a political strategy very often to achieve their own political ends. And this has saturated, unfortunately, Muslim public opinion. There's a lot of confusion. So the intention is to make it quite clear. Like we did the section on Madhab, what exactly it is, going back into its history, we need to understand that Shiism is just a sect. But in no way does that justify the wholesale destruction of a Muslim land simply because its leaders are Shia, like we find in Syria. The notion that there's a Shiite-Sunni conflict in Iraq and in Syria, and that this is a religious battle, is actually not true, as we'll discover through the next two or three bayans. So that's something we need to keep separate. Our position vis-a-vis a fractured sectarian grouping, as our position is with all other sectarian groupings in our history, and what is currently happening in the world today. What we did mention is that the subversion of the Muslim lands, and we'll explore this over the next 2 weeks, is the work of Israel, which is the chief beneficiary of the weakening of those Arab governments. They're not Islamic governments, including Saudi Arabia. Those are not Islamic governments. They're Arab governments, but nevertheless, in spite of the inadequacy, the corruption and the incompetence, they still do, to a large degree, serve the better interests of the Arab people. Not necessarily Islam, but definitely the Arab people, the majority of whom are Muslim, and that is our concern. The well-being of Muslims. We know that Israel is putting into motion its final solution, its clean break strategy, which is what we'll talk about a little later. It's a campaign to put nation against nation. We talked about this during the quite lengthy bayan on the end times and the ahadith in which the Prophet ﷺ guides us through these very confusing times. He predicts what is to happen, and we see it unfolding before our eyes. So the result, really, of Israel's scheming, the Zionist agenda, is a smoldering planet that is ruined. And Israel wants to rule over the ashes and the mass graves. It wants to cull the population to the point that the world population is manageable. This is a foregone conclusion, unfortunately. Israel plans also to move troops into Syria. And we'll talk a little later about how strategic Syria is, like Iraq, like Egypt, like Libya. Saudi Arabia is going to be fractured very soon. Turkey is a king, which we know is the Dajjal. Find that there are people who actually think exactly like what I've just described. And these are words and thoughts and attitudes that emanate from the highest of power in the world, who are insane world, and sleeping. While dictatorship, while injustice has been surrounding them. In reality, we find the Arab world, which was no doubt part of the Islamic world, a part of the Khilafah, has been filled with frequent rabbis of the Khilafah. But what is being targeted are the European states, particularly the Anglo-American states like the United States and England. They are the ruling state of the world, and in order for Israel to emerge as a ruling state, they have to exist. If it is in the United States now, this will war, however, that the manifestation of these colonial designs, in fact, they are erstwhile crusader designs. Remember when Allenby marches into Jerusalem, what does he boast? But now the crusaders have finally come to an end. So this crusader mentality, unfortunately, still to the West, they seem to be in a... There's an invasion of Syria that's planned. There's a splitting of the Kurdish region of Iraq, which is already underway. There will be an Israeli-controlled military bastion for invasion of Iran from there, which is already underway. What isn't, however, is that if the United States back to war, after a decade of military defeat, the United States won war from enjoying any freedom. Look at Algeria, for example, Libya under the Italians, Egypt under the English and the French, Sudan. These European colonial powers very ingeniously managed then to portray themselves as friends and allies of Arab liberation. More than 100. This is just an occupied. They rule through threat and through violence against civilian populations. But nevertheless, they are the dominant world power. Now, they'll be drawn back into a war. After more than a decade of military and economic disaster, and America is falling apart, there are more than 50 million people stuck in the streets of the US today. Obviously, that won't be the 7 years. There's been a false flag. You know, this is a case in point for anyone who knows that part of history, which essentially led to the creation of modern-day Israel, the most abominable creation the world has ever seen. France and Britain merely used and manipulated the Arabs by selling them the idea of an Arab liberation, nationalism, and liberation from the so-called repression of the Ottomans. That they're Turks, they're oppressing you, we need to fight against them. So the fascism talked about, unfortunately, this drama, assassination of an American president. It's planning the people for what will be an open assault on the sovereignty of the United States. Also, there's been 100 new 9/11 style terror attacks that have been planned and are also necessary for Israel to be kicked at this stage. And the ground has already been laid, Boston, Maryland, is completely clear for chain directly occupation of American cities. The first, even the Armenian genocide, in fact, it would ensue in the Ottoman Anatolian regions, has to be analyzed in the same context as a contemporary targeting, for example, of Christians in Syria today or in Egypt or Iraq as part of a sectarian scheme that has been unleashed by external actors. And this was done 100 years ago, in fact, to divide the Ottoman Khilafah, to divide Anatolia and the citizens of the Khilafah Uthmaniyah. And eventually that led to the disintegration of the Khilafah Uthmaniyah. The veil is being thin. Anyone knows economics? You can literally break and make empires through financial manipulation. And this is currently what's been happening in the United States and globally. And Wall Street has been at the forefront of it. In the Middle East, you find Israel is coordinating with Saudi Arabia. Other Gulf states, along Turkey. We find in Turkey, PKK terrorists, key leaders in the Kurdish government of Iraq. We find Al-Qaeda led the Druze militia. So we've been there, we've done that, and we paid a very heavy price, but foolish Muslims are doing it exactly the same way twice over. After the collapse of the Khilafah Uthmaniyah, it was actually London and Paris which denied freedom to the Arabs. So the Arabs fought a proxy war on their behalf. The Khilafah Uthmaniyah was dismantled. The rise of Al Saud under the patronage of Her Royal Majesty Queen Victoria and receiving a handsome sum of a sterling, a fitting price in Israel. And the Al-Qaeda Wahhabi allies. Remember I said we'll talk about Wahhabism and the emergence of Al Saud as a surrogate of the United, at least of Great Britain and then the United States in its wars against the Ottoman Khilafah first, and then essentially its subversion of the establishment or re-establishment of Khilafah. Habis, or return to Quran and have a more fundamental principle is Khilafah. The greatest is Mamlaka. There's no national kingdom. But somehow, having been trained in school in Western universities and essentially being Western in everything but name. And all too happy to be clients of Britain and France. So if you look at our history, not too distant history, and look at what's happening today, the so-called Arab Spring is another manipulation of the Arabs, unfortunately, by West.